Film Spotting is presented by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I'm Sam Van Halgren. On this week's show, Adam and I reveal the five movies you shouldn't miss this fall.
Last week, we counted down our individual 6 through 10 list.
Or 15.
Or 15 in your case. This week, we'll share our joint top five, plus listener feedback, Massacre Theater, and music from Danbert No Bacon.
Danbert No Bacon.
Yes.
Can I make a quick... I know we're only in the intro here, but can I just mention quickly, Carrie and I bought a house in Cudahy, Wisconsin, just recently.
Uh-huh.
It is the home of Cudahy bacon, and you can actually smell bacon in the morning and in the evening when I get home. I can't tell you how glorious a thing that is.
It sounds like my dream house.
All right. Well, first, Adam and I get nostalgic for the Salt Lake City Quality Inn with a pair of recently released Sundance favorites, starting with Rocket Science.
The high school debate. Kids wielding words like weapons and brandishing ideas like axes. Al Hefner had hardly a voice at all.
Good morning, both. You are esteemed opponents. Good morning.
Deformed people are the best. Maybe it's because they have a deep resource of anger. So here I am, ferreting out the debating talent from the masses.
It was like a little wave breaking over him, and it said the name, Ginny. Ginny. All his life, his brain had been waiting for this thought.
I'm glad you came to me because this is exactly the sort of problem that mommy and daddy would royally screw up.
Rocket Science and Interview both debuted at the 2007 Sundance Film Festival, and both neatly fall into two distinct but familiar Sundance movie camps. We'll get to Interview in the next segment, but Rocket Science's indie film marking should have been pretty obvious from the clip you just heard. Quirky coming-of-age story? Check. Awkward high school student desperately chasing a girl, subjecting himself to hours of abject self-loathing and humiliation? Check. Ironic voiceover, hipster soundtrack, cast of unknowns? Check, check, and check. Specifically, Rocket Science can fairly be compared to 2005's Thumbsucker, which also deals with a quote-unquote deformed teen who tries to overcome his problems by joining the debate team, in addition to perhaps the entire Wes Anderson canon. But the real shadow hanging over writer-director Jeffrey Blitz is his own breakout 2002 debut, Spellbound, a documentary that followed eight contestants on their quest for National Spelling Bee immortality. Spellbound was nominated for an Oscar, earned critical raves, and won several festival awards, and is beloved by really every person I know who has seen it, including you, Sam.
Yes.
Does Rocket Science have you eagerly awaiting Blitz's next fiction film foray, or recommending a return to nonfiction?
No, I actually look a great deal forward to what Jeffrey Blitz has next in terms of narrative. Whether he wants to go back to documentary himself or not, I'll watch that too. I did. Like you said, I loved Spellbound. I was talking with somebody over last weekend who referred to a film as their secret favorite film of 2005. He said, in this case, I think in 2002, my secret favorite film was Spellbound. I think if I had put a top 10 list together, I don't know if it would have made it to number one, but I did adored that film. And this film sort of had me coming around to it. So like I said, as a director of a narrative film like this film, I think Blitz is actually incredibly gifted. As a screenwriter, I'm not entirely sold. And that's, I guess, where the problems with the film were to me. And I guess it's not so much the screenwriting, in that I don't want to suggest that I think he's a bad screenwriter, because actually I don't. I think it might just be a personal kind of taste thing for me. The entire way through this film, I was really battling between, really kind of loving this film and being annoyed by it, and realizing that, you mentioned, of course, yes, deeply indebted to Wes Anderson. People have mentioned Todd Solondz. Certainly, I wonder if when Jeffrey Blitz saw Thumbsucker, he thought, well, damn you. You already made my film. But given all that, I think this film really is a balancing act between my favorite film, and many people out there will know where I'm going in terms of Wes Anderson, but also, and it's unfair to say, my least favorite film, but a film that I think really annoys me, which is Jared Hess and Napoleon Dynamite. It's that sort of deadpan absurdism that I think doesn't work so well in this film when it comes to the side characters, supporting characters, which I don't think really contribute a whole lot to the plot. The other film, of course, that it a favorite film of mine that it reminds me of a great deal is Bottle Rocket, Wes Anderson's first film. And the reason is because the reason this film eventually worked for me, that is Rocket Science, is that I loved the central character, Hal Hefner. He was never just the sum of his quirks at all, nor is Ginny Ryerson, his the female lead, who I think is also just incredible.
Yeah.
And so there's a real emotional core to this film that I loved and eventually won me over to the point where I really actually strongly recommend this film if I was occasionally annoyed by some of the side characters, which just seem to exist as comic set pieces.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I also made a note about the supporting characters with this film and how many of them felt to me like they actually could have been cast-off contestants from Spellbound. You've got various types of characters appear here, but the problem is it is a fiction film, a 90-100-minute film or whatever, and they do sort of feel, unfortunately, just like types, like they've been a little bit broadly drawn, as opposed to the people we really get to spend a lot of time with in Spellbound and get to know. So I think that's part of it. I think, in general, we're pretty much on the same page with this film. I agree that some of the absurdity of the screenplay at times, there are some great lines, some really funny moments, and then some other times where you feel like he was just reaching a little bit too much. But I do really applaud Jeffrey Blitz for a couple things, and one of them is something I meant to bring up with Superbad and didn't have time to get into it, is that he shows high school in a realistic way, I think. The movie isn't interested in cliques or about people trying to be popular. A kid like Hal, played by Rhys Thompson, who, you're right, he's really good here, he's really just left alone. And you can see how some of the characters could easily move between different groups, different cliques pretty freely, which is really the way high school is, I think, as opposed to what we see justifiably in a satire like Heather's.
Yeah, so, loneliness may be the biggest condition people suffer in high school, not abuse, really.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree with that. And I also think, and I have to be vague here because I don't want to give anything away, but I really do also applaud him for having the conviction to be really depressing and to not give us the payoff or the payoffs I think we all want and expect. I know certainly I wanted. The way a movie like Thumbsucker even does to an extent, in the way most movies would, it's very frustrating, and at the same time, I think it's really rewarding.
Oh, I think it's really rewarding and satisfying, yeah.
Yeah, but I think while I definitely liked it like you, and I laughed at it, as I said, and I do recommend it, I already have even dropped one line to you in an email, there's a cello in your living room, which cracks me up whenever I think about it. There were some issues, I think, that kept me from totally embracing it, and it wasn't even so much the screenplay as it was some of the plot details, but also that Wes Anderson thing, that absurdist style. And I heard Blitz on The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell discussing his visual strategy, and he talked about how, you know, he talked with the cinematographer about how they didn't want to do anything handheld. It had to be a very formal way because they had to really move between easily. It had to facilitate really emotional, kind of heavy moments, and then quickly jumping to something really ridiculous. But what we get then is this total Wes Anderson copy where it is very formal, the camera doesn't move at all, and it's very still, and the frames are all usually square on their subjects. And then you add in the use of music, which, again, it's sometimes very funny, but there are also times where it almost starts to feel too episodic. Like every 3 minutes we get a musical interlude and voiceover narration, which also makes you think of Wes Anderson. Sure. It all started to feel a little too familiar and I guess a little too precocious.
Yeah, but I mean, with a lot of like first-time efforts, I mean, I have to, not that I admire him for this, but it's not uncommon for somebody to be like, wow, you know what, I want to make a movie like Rushmore, you know, or whatever, and go out and try to, and that's your standard, and okay, you can be fairly accused of trying to copy someone, but I think what he shows me that sort of separates him from Wes Anderson is a real talent for directing. Actors, particularly young actors in this case. I mean, certainly actors I've not seen before. And the tone of the performances is remarkably consistent and really unique and funny. And even his depiction of Hal Hefner's stutter, which is the central dilemma, is very specific. He's not just a stutterer. He has a very specific stutter and a very specific problem in some way. And so I think that's what I really admired it for. Yeah, I could recognize all the and you know, the references, and in terms of like what he was being, what he was obviously shooting for in terms of a tone and everything. Mm-hmm. But I do think, you know, that's why maybe it's not a perfect film, but I think he has a real talent. And again, if I didn't really love all of the little bits that he put together, absurdist bits and that sort of style, I have a feeling that Blitz will mature into a filmmaker at this point, I would say, that could be an equal of a Wes Anderson. I don't see any reason why that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, it's fair to assume he's really kind of still finding his voice. This is obviously his first fiction film, and I agree with you. The way he directs the actors and the performances he gets are all really good, especially those two lead performances, the actress Anna Kendrick as Ginny, as the overachiever, and then Rhys Thompson, as we said, as Hal. I mean, they are really good. I think that one thing that did hold me up a little bit, and I don't want to get into it because, again, I kind of have to be vague because I don't want to give away plot details, but I wonder if you had any of these issues, Sam, at all, is that I've talked to some of my friends. I actually have a couple of very good friends, college roommates, who were debaters in high school, and this exact type of debate and everything they've seen in the movie in terms of previews and then also what I've told them, they say it gets it dead on. I mean, they're just cracking up because they had to do all of those exact same things that we see happen in the movie. And, of course, it should be realistic because Blitz really was this kid, Hal Hefner, in many ways, from what he talked about on the treatment and interviews I've read. You know, he did have a stuttering problem, and then he got through it, and he was this overachiever as a debater in high school. But I never really bought his inclusion on the team. I'll just kind of say it that way. I never bought that the teacher in this program, who obviously wants to win and takes it so seriously, would actually let him get up there without ever seeing any development in his stuttering, no matter who his partner is, in this case, Ginny. And I also, by the end, and again, I'm not giving anything away here, I felt like I never bought Ginny's motivation for asking for him to be included on the team, for seeking him out and saying, you should be my partner. We see different reasons kind of come up as the film goes on. If you really start to pick them apart, I don't think they actually make any realistic sense at all. And again, maybe that's too much to ask because this is kind of an absurdist film, but I don't think they make any realistic sense. I started thinking about those things as the movie went on, and it did hurt it for me a little bit.
I don't know. I feel like I have defenses for all those things. First of all, would Hal, with his really terrible stutter, be included on the team? I don't know. The high school I went to, if you showed up, you were a participant. I mean, it was a small enough school was, hey, look, we have a uniform to fit you, you're on the team, even if you're sitting on the bench.
But you wouldn't have been in the number one spot.
She had put so much faith in the Ginny character that she totally let her own that. And as far as, like, recruiting him, Ginny's recruitment of Hal, I feel like that is kind of justified because it points out this, like, insight into how a teenager would use logic. She understands this about, you know, people that have something to overcome. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's her logic for choosing him and others, as we learn. And I don't know, for me, I was just like, yeah, that's kind of a high school girl's logic that doesn't quite work out. I don't know. I mean, for me, it was enough.
It is enough, except that then the movie gives us another explanation later for why she may have really sought him out. And then I think certain questions start to arise. So again, I know I'm nitpicking, but those were a couple things for me. But I agree. I, like you, will be looking for it. I mean, I like Spellbound, not as much as you or everyone else. For some reason, I didn't love that film, but I didn't adore it. But I do like it a lot, and I like this film, and I do look forward to seeing what Blitz has next.
All right. Well, Rocket Science is currently out in limited release. If you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, we'll find out if Sam can surprise me and not absolutely hate Interview. Stay with us.
I hear voices, the ghosts of empires past. I hear voices, the ghosts of empires yet to breathe their last. I hear voices, it's not like I got any choice in this, but first things first, says one who died of thirst.
You're gonna have to forgive me, I don't usually do this.
Wait, you don't normally do interviews?
Not with actresses.
Okay.
Yeah, I usually handle politics. And I'm sorry, I have not seen any of your films.
I think we'll just get the check, please.
I just want wanna see that smile, that killer smile. Got
you. You just drive, please.
Damn, you don't know who that is?
Watch it.
This really wasn't necessary, you know.
Shut up. Besides, I almost feel responsible.
Well, you should. This is all your fault. It's that killer smile that causes car wrecks.
I do better when you're drunk.
Don't look at me.
Why do you choose only the most commercial crap that's out there?
Welcome back to Film Spotting. That's a clip from the trailer for the 2007 film Interview. Sienna Miller as the actress Katya, an amalgam of tabloid princesses like Paris Hilton and, frankly, herself, and Steve Buscemi as Pierre, a disgruntled political reporter assigned to the lowly task of interviewing such a vapid subject. As I discuss with Rocket Science Sam, Interview is the other type of Sundance movie, the one that gives an indie film hero like Buscemi the chance to show off his chops in front of and behind the camera, and offers an actor not known for their acting chops a chance to prove that they can really act. And this is really a cat-and-mouse movie. You have two characters essentially locked in a room, toying with and guiding each other to their own selfish destinations. Did all of the antipathy, by the end, Sam, pay off for you?
No.
No. No surprises here.
Not the least. I was really surprised. I love Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
I guess by the end, I really found myself surprised that he would take something like this on in the way that it's executed, knowing that he adapted the screenplay from Theo Van Gogh's original Interview, which came out in 2003. That this was the sort of depth of his observational skills about humanity in some way. I was like, well, this is who he really is. If I admired him as an actor, this is who he is as a writer and director. And I was not impressed. And I was really just sort of turned off by the execution of it. And again, I haven't seen Theo Van Gogh's original film, so I don't know how much he sort of took in terms of like the personas of the two individuals. Of course, the part played by Buscemi, he's just really this caustic and jaded political reporter. And I guess so much didn't work for me here. And again, you know, just how ugly things get, I guess I feel like isn't justified. And maybe that's what you're mm-hmm. pointing out in terms of that's Sam's critique of things. If you're gonna suffer, you better have it justified in some mm-hmm. way. And I don't feel like it ever is. Structurally, though, in terms of the big problem for me is like the question always has to be, how do these two people end up staying in the same room? How does the filmmaker and the writer keep these two people who don't like each other in the same room? And for me, that goes unsatisfied. There are a number of moments where either he has to convince her to let him stay, or she has to convince him to stay, or she has to convince, whatever, those variations. And none of them work. All of them feel forced. The fact that he would stick around in her apartment, the fact that she would let him stick around, don't work for me. And then the problem becomes, why should I care about either of these people and what they hope to get out of the interview or over the course of this evening? And I hate to say this because I know I sound redundant and this sounds like such a cliche for me to say it, but I just didn't care about either of them. And I think the dynamic is wrong in this case, as far as what we should see him undergo. Here's this character who, by all, everything we know about him from the very earliest scenes, has no respect for women, just treats them like sex objects in some way. There are numerous examples of that in terms of experiences with prostitutes. And so why should it be more surprising that he ends up treating his interview subject or seeing his interview subject as a sexual object? I think there's this potential for something really interesting to happen where, let's say, a political reporter, who just isn't really interested in his subject, you know, finds himself sexually attracted to his interview subject. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a sort of cloud that he's not accustomed to, that he has to deal with. You know, that is potentially interesting. I mean, Sienna Miller, this idea of, you know, sexualized celebrities and the power they wield. I mean, that is an interesting sort of concept to explore. But in this case, the interviewer already sees women in general as sex objects. So there's nothing for him to transform or be challenged by. So that's one of many criticisms I have, or maybe I listed two, but I'll let you jump in.
Well, it's interesting because I did see this movie 2 months ago or more. Right. So it's not as fresh in my mind as it is in yours. I have to say, off the top of my head, I don't remember that being explicitly clear that he was that much of a misogynist. He clearly feels that way towards her, and the movie does set up certain reasons why he may have distrust of women. But in terms of just a general outlook on the world and women, that he hates them all or he sees them all as prostitutes in a way, I didn't completely get that sense. That's fine. I think you may be onto something. I didn't get that sense. And in terms of them being convincing as to why they stay in the same room, I felt like they did come up with enough reasons to keep them there. And the main reason is that they're both really desperate, unhappy, loathsome people who actually, in a way, like, this is fun for them. This is about the only thing they can do is to be around other people in a way like themselves. And there's just a reason why they keep looking internally to come up with a reason to stay or to keep that person around, for Katya to keep Pierre in her apartment. So I think I was kind of convinced by that. And in terms of the sexuality part, too, the fact that Sienna Miller's character recognizes that and uses her sexuality against him, even though he tries to act like it has no effect on him. He doesn't sleep with celebrities, and she says, I think, you know, I don't sleep with nobodies, I think is the line. Yeah. The fact that she uses that against him and he can't go past it, he can't overcome it, he totally does succumb to it, I think is kind of interesting. Maybe it's no surprise that I did like this film more than you did, if anyone remembers our discussion of the movie Closer.
Right.
That's another movie. Yeah. I thought about a lot. It's, again, kind of theatrical, all takes place in one room or a couple rooms, and has really just repugnant characters in it. And mm-hmm. and by the end, I don't know that there is any payoff in terms of you caring about them, but by the end, I felt like even though I didn't care about them, I was still taken somewhere and was still interested in their stories. And I get back to that idea, Sam, of the cat and mouse game. By the end, it only pays off. The movie only works for me if by the end, the two actors, the two performers, have managed to convince me that I don't really know where this is going. That the act that they're performing on the other character in the film,
right,
to convince them that they're a certain kind of person and to get them where they want them to go, is also working on me, so that by the end, when we get the last 5 minutes of the film, that there is somewhat of a surprise there, that there is a shock, that we go for a second, wow, I thought I knew that person. Even though that's totally ridiculous,
right,
they managed to convince me as performers that, wow, I thought I knew them, and here now they've turned the table on me, and I feel duped. If it doesn't do that, then it doesn't work. It did that for me.
Yeah, no.
It worked for me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, if you're surprised by the end, then I think this film can work. That was just yet another problem for me. The surprise, and I don't want to say twist, because that's maybe overstating it.
No.
But didn't work at all for me. I saw it coming from miles away, and that's not something I'm usually capable of doing. I want to make that clear. The other thing, because there are a number of potentially interesting things coming up here, in addition to, you know, the dealing with the legitimate power of beauty, sexuality, celebrity, that is interesting and I think ineffectively done. Then you have this notion of, by the end of it, you know nothing really about the celebrity who is the subject of the interview, and really maybe everything about the interviewer. That is something that's potentially interesting, that, again,
yes,
because
is.
Of the way the surprise works at the end, doesn't feel at all interesting or really effective either. And then there are a few other things in here which I feel like come way too late. This whole notion, I don't know if you remember this, because it's only a couple moments in the film where it really tries to create this parallel between the father-daughter relationship, mm-hmm. And explore this whole Elektra complex almost, in terms of him trying to relive an experience with his estranged daughter that he never had. And it's really kind of a funny moment, and I think if I had any sympathy for the film, I would have kind of admired what Buscemi did here, where he really has this whole scene where Buscemi's character kind of acts out how he would have acted if he had a teenage daughter. This whole mm-hmm. idea of, like, he read her diary, she flips out, and he wants to have a serious conversation with her about this, like, really depressed, poetry that she's written in her diary. And it's just like, that is exactly the kind of experience that a parent would have in terms of, you know, over-dramatizing something that is just very typical of a teenager to do. I thought that was potentially a very clever thing that, for me, came way too late in the screenplay and almost seemed like a desperate attempt to salvage what was going on there. And again, another desperate attempt to try to keep these two people in the same room. And at that point, it's not that I had given up on them, but I certainly didn't have any interest in seeing where they were going.
Well, again, like I said, I think that by the end, their perception of characters, of each other, has to change, has to evolve and go through some process, and it clearly does by the end of the film. As an audience, our perception of those two characters has to change. We go on the same journey that they each go through with each other in terms of their perceptions of the actress, the vapid actress, and the reporter. And then at the end, even though they change, they don't come to necessarily a place where it's simply good or bad or smart or dumb. I think there are enough layers there that instead it just comes out being really depressing because it's just really – it's cynical, but cynical in a way that is – accurate, I think. I think it's very accurate about life, about characters probably like this, and it worked for me. I had that moment at the end where I was like, wow, it worked on me. They managed to fool me. And so with that in mind, I recommend it.
Yeah, and it was interesting, too. I hate to recast movies. Actually, I love recasting movies.
Yes, you do.
Movies.
What are you saying?
But if you look at what the original interview did, Theo van Gogh's, it looks like he took a real-life Dutch star, Katja Schumann, and this journalist. And I guess Sienna Miller, to me, isn't enough of a celebrity. I was trying to think of who might be an appropriate fill-in for that, where the boundary between what's real and what's fiction is clear, because I don't know anything about Sienna Miller. I know she had some relationship with Jude Law, apparently,
right,
but she's not enough of like a tabloid staple for me to really
not here, not
feel
in the
like,
US.
The comment between reality and fiction is blurry. Let me give you a suggestion. There are probably a million of them. Jen Aniston.
Okay.
If she had been in this role, she's such a tabloid staple. You know, she's somebody that could be fairly accused, like Buscemi does accuse Sienna Miller, of like choosing these puff roles, these horror movies and nothing substantial. That's something you could say about Jennifer Aniston, who's potentially a really talented actress. I know there are people out there that could disagree with me, but chooses time and time again these vacuous roles. And so that criticism could really hit home on a fictional level and on a real level, where here I feel like we're missing something too, because Sienna Miller, I really don't care about her as a personality or as an actress. So that's another loss for me.
I think that's a really interesting point. I actually don't disagree with you on that. I think a more interesting line being blurred there between fact and fiction, between reality and fantasy, would actually be really interesting. And I agree that Jennifer Aniston is a perfect pick. You can think about different layers that would be there in the performance, or as an audience member, what we would read into those moments because of her tabloid status. At the same time, as much as I have liked Jennifer Aniston in some movies, including, well, really, maybe only because of
the breakup,
the fact is I'm not sure that she has the chops that Sienna Miller has.
This is the exact vehicle for us to find out, though.
Maybe. Maybe so.
Unfortunately, we will have to wait for Interview 2. All right. Well, Interview is still playing in limited release. I know it's still playing in Milwaukee and maybe elsewhere. You can decide for yourselves if you've seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
We're going to take another short break. When we come back, Massacre Theater, and we answer the burning question on every film spotter's mind. Sure, Maddie Ballgame is great, but can he hate like Sam? Stay with us.
Straight talking, what's a little bit of warning? Bird a holding business opportunity to read back at some real estate. Some folks call it a party bag. Sunburn here, rub the snake oil on your chest. From Pittsburgh to Fort Lauderdale, from Burnley to Marseille, that little choice to make the traffic run the other way.
What?
We stop at Pancakes House.
What are you, nuts? We have pancakes for breakfast. Gotta go to a place where I can get a shot and a beer and steak, maybe. Not more fucking pancakes. Come on. Oh, come on, man. Okay, here's an idea. We can stop outside of Brainerd, and then we'll place there we can get laid. What do you think?
I'm fucking hungry now, you know.
Yeah, yeah, Jesus. I'm saying we can stop, get pancakes, and then we'll get laid, all right?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I destroy a beloved screenplay, and you get a shot at a free DVD. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from Fargo, a tie-in with part one of our fall movie preview.
Go Bears. Yeah. A lot of things to mention here regarding Fargo and our Massacre Theater. You did get a lot of love for your Steve Buscemi by way of Woody Allen impression.
That's right.
And also, we have to note that Jared sent in a fabulous YouTube clip. It's been posted on YouTube. Sam, have you watched it?
I have. It's really something.
It's called Chihuahua instead of Fargo, because it's, of course, Chicago and Milwaukee. And it's his version of our version of the scene from Fargo. So if you want to check out, come to filmspotting.net, and we'll put the link in the notes to this show. It really is funny and something worth checking out. And it does, of course, tie in with our fall movie preview. Could the Coen brothers have a movie coming out?
We'll find out
in the next segment.
All right, we'll reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Jeffrey Wedig. I believe Jeffrey's from Pennsylvania. We do appreciate if you include your locations when you send in Massacre Theater. We love to know where everyone's from. But Jeffrey is our winner. Congratulations. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
Monty used to act.
Well, I hardly say that. It's true I crept the boards in my youth, but I never really had it in my blood, and that's what's essential, isn't it? Theatrical zeal in the veins.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. It also ties in with our fall movie preview. I think it will be pretty obvious from that when we get into that next segment. It also ties in, I think it's fair to say, just with Film Spotting in general.
That's true.
In the larger sense. And maybe even some topical news right now.
Yeah, gosh.
But we're not going to get into that. So I think
that's
I've totally given it away.
Account.
People
yeah.
can already start emailing in the answer before we've gotten to the scene. You give me the direction.
All right. And action.
It's over. We're broke. We're going to go home.
First of all, what is broke to you? You're so spoiled, man. Having only a few hundred dollars is not broke. Okay, this is a setback. We hitchhiked. What is this? All right, $16. So where's the rest of the money?
You gave it to Inez.
No, I never gave Inez anything.
In the envelope.
Pointless act! You don't give a $500 tip to the housekeeper! That's inappropriate. That's inexcusable. That I do not forgive. What were you thinking?
Don't call her the housekeeper.
What were you thinking?
Don't call her the housekeeper.
Don't threaten me. That's what she is. She's a housekeeper, right? People are housekeepers.
You better watch it, Blank. You don't know what you're talking about right now.
Don't threaten me. Don't threaten me, man.
Her name's Inez.
And my name's Blank, man. So what? She didn't love you, man.
And scene. And I think you went into a little bit of Matthew McConaughey there. At the end, Sam.
That would actually be okay.
It would be okay.
I think, actually.
It would be. All right. Well, if you know what film Sam and I just massacred, and how could you not, really,
send
us an email by Wednesday, September 5th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's show. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Hey, Adam and Sam. This is Rabbi Joe in Jerusalem. I love the show, but talk about coincidence spotting. The very day that I finally make my way all the way through the archives, I'm finally caught up, and Sam's leaving the show. I can't believe it. But you've got 3 shows left, Sam, so you can still correct your biggest mistake. Admit that Superman Returns is worse than The Quest for Peace. I mean, you're choosing between Kevin Spacey and Gene Hackman. It really should not be that hard.
Hey, guys. Thomas from Nashville saying sorry to hear about Sam's departure. Not a surprise because you were gone so much, but you just added a whole lot to my enjoyment of films, and so thank you very much for what you've done. Have a blessed retirement, and Adam, I'm glad you're there. I like you better anyway. I'm just kidding. All right, bye guys.
Hey guys, this is Brett Merriman in California. Have my own top 5 list, top 5 things I'll do now that Sam is gone. Number 5, steal Haitian divorce idea. Number 4, look at Maddie Ballgame with suspicion. Number 3, anticipate more discussion about films from the 80s. Number 2, cancel my name change. And the number 1 thing I'll do now that Sam is gone, really miss that big lug. Good luck, Sam.
Some wonderful voicemails there, Sam, yeah. commenting on your big announcement last yeah. week, the bombshell that you are leaving the show. And I don't know, maybe he was just taking a deep breath, but it sounded like Brett Sparta-Merriman got a little choked up there.
Maybe a little bit. Brett Sparta-Merriman. And as far as stealing Haitian Divorce, I think I already named him as my co-writer.
That's
so
true.
So really, this is a partnership, Brett. And really, I guess I didn't say this last week, but that's why I'm leaving the show. Brett and I are going to put together Haitian Divorce. Mm-hmm. We've already got the cast, as we discussed, a month or so ago. So it was just time to delve into something more creative
yeah.
on my end. And Haitian Divorce was my ticket, really.
Well, have you been able to land Michel Gondry yet as the director?
Of course.
Okay. Well,
he'd heard through the grapevine. But no, I do really want to thank everybody. It really has been completely overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the voicemails, but emails people have sent. And I've been describing it as like Tom Sawyer attending your own funeral. I mean, it really is, I feel just blessed, really, by what everyone has written in. And I have to admit, Adam, I mean, you should try quitting the show at least once.
Sometimes
and of course,
I'm tempted.
Triumphant comeback, whatever it takes.
Uh-huh.
But it really was just an incredible thing to hear from everybody out there. So I want to thank everybody that took the time to write in.
Yeah, it's been a great outpouring of love for you, Sam. All deserved. It has been really good for me as well. It's been very encouraging. Everyone's written in and said, this
yes.
is bad. We're really depressed. We're really sad. But
yeah.
you know what? At least the show isn't stopping.
Yeah, and everyone's really excited about Maddie Ballgame. I
yeah.
think everyone was really grateful to you, too, that they got to hear a full show with Maddie a couple weeks ago. So
yeah, that worked out really well. Are you going to follow Rabbi Joe in Jerusalem's advice and try to atone for Superman?
You know what? I never saw Quest for Peace, so I can't actually do that.
Oh, a cop out.
I stick by, even as I walk out, I could remedy so many issues people had with my review of Superman Returns, but no, I stick by it. It was a religious experience of sorts, and that's my memory of it. Whether I'll revisit it at any point, I don't know.
Yeah, I think we could talk about some of these emails forever, and we're not going to, but I think a couple of my favorite common themes here is emails like Liz Jewart's writing in. I think she was at the beach with her boyfriend, and she's like, she's listening on her iPod, she's got the headphones, and she just turns to her boyfriend with this terrible panic-stricken look on her face, and he's like, what is it, honey? What could it be? You know, it's Sam's leaving film spotting. It's like the end of the world. I love reading
right.
that. And I also love, of course, hearing people write in or reading people say how it got a little dusty during
yeah.
the announcement. I think we're just going to have to finally pay Bill Simmons some royalties for that.
we've completely taken it from him. I don't know who owns the rights to that now, either us or Bill Simmons. But yeah.
We've
yeah,
totally
and,
appropriated
where was
it.
I when Sam announced his retirement? Just, yeah, like I said, pretty incredible stuff.
Speaking of Sam and you leaving the show, your final show is coming up, and
yeah.
we're going to talk about what we will discuss on that show here, tying in with our poll question from last week. We asked you, which of these star pairings, each in movies opening September 7th, excites you the most? Russell Crowe and Christian Bale in the movie 310 to Yuma, Clive Owen and Paul Giamatti, who are in Shoot 'Em Up, or Will Arnett and Will Forte in the comedy The Brothers Solomon. How did it come out, Sam?
Well, it came out just as you read them. 55% named Yuma as their number one choice of those three, Russell Crowe and Christian Bale, followed by Clive Owen and Paul Giamatti in Shoot 'Em Up, and then Will Arnett and Will Forte at 7%. So, yeah, but I think, yeah, a lot of enthusiasm for those. I realized how difficult it was for me to pick it until I
mm-hmm.
really considered, I mean, Bale and Crowe. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tough to argue with that. It actually was maybe even a little closer than I thought it would be,
yeah,
though.
Maybe.
So that was nice to see. And on the show, we wanted to lay out for you what Sam's last show would look like. And I really got to thank you, Sam, for suggesting this, because of course we would love to give you a full show. I know we're just going to depress listeners even more, but next week's show completely coincides with my trip, Maddie's trip
to the Toronto
International Film Festival. We'll actually be recording your show, and then later that day I'm getting on the plane. And the last thing I want to do is really focus on a previous show when I'm trying to really get into Toronto.
Right.
And you were nice enough to suggest, you know what, why are we doing a full show? Let's just get something done. Let's get a
yep.
shortened show. And we came up with an idea where we're going to do a review. We're going to do a two-segment show, basically a 30-minute show, and we're going to talk about Shoot 'Em Up. Of course, we'd rather talk about 310 to Yuma. It didn't work out with
yeah.
our schedules, and we feel like, hey, if we have to go with option B there, Clive Owen and Paul Giamatti,
not bad. Yeah.
It's not too bad. That'll work for us. So we're going to talk about Shoot 'Em Up, and then we're going to do Massacre Theater, and we're going to do our top five farewells. So if you already have some good ideas for your favorite movie farewells, please send them in. Yeah. But that will be our top five. And then we're also going to sprinkle the show with some of your favorite Sam moments, your fantastic moments. So please email in your favorite Sam moments, or you can go to filmspotting.net and click on
Love
the boards
lift
link.
Lift us up where we belong.
Exactly. Yeah. You know it's going to be in there. go to show discussion on our boards, and you can post some of your favorite moments in there. So that is something we look forward to, finding those moments and kind of reliving some of the magic.
Oh, the magic.
That is Sam Van Hallgren. And we have to then address the tease we ended the last segment with about, can Maddie hate the way Sam hates? And we got a great email. Again, we've received a ton of great emails, but this one ended really in a nice way from Chris in Australia, who concluded with, I won't crap on any longer as you don't know me from a bar of soap, and I'm not a freakish stalker. Mate, best of luck. Adam, good luck filling the void, and I have a good feeling so far about Maddie B, which a lot of other people have written in and said, does he have a real last name? If you were listening to the show 2 weeks ago, I said his real last name two or three times. So it is in there.
But it will remain a mystery.
It will remain a mystery. Maybe we'll have Maddie try to explain where the nickname came from. But anyway, Chris ends his email by saying, but can Maddie hate like Sam? No, I don't think he can. And Sam, you actually think he can.
I think he can. And I guess this is my advice to Maddie. And I guess this is maybe a reflection of what I hoped I conveyed in the course of my hating, is that you have to love in equal measure.
Mm-hmm.
The Vanperbole goes both ways. It's a masterpiece. It's the worst film I've ever made. You need to have both sides of the spectrum there. And I will put out an additional mystery about Maddie Ballgame. If people can answer the question, who is Cassota Stone?
Yes.
That is another question for you all to contemplate. It's like the opening of Atlas Shrugged.
Uh-huh.
Who is John Galt? Who is Cassota Stone? Work on that, if you will. Puzzle it out.
All right. Well, we also wanted to mention a quick email. Sander Weiss, our good friend Sandy here in the Chicago area, wrote in mentioning something that other people have as well about maybe the possibility of us ever doing a live show. And Sam, that was something we always kicked around.
We've talked about it for years,
Yeah, we really wanted to do that, some kind of big film spotting gathering in Chicago where maybe we record a live show and have everyone out, maybe rent out a bar or something or a movie theater. And we just couldn't get it done. We can barely get the show done. But I just wanted to throw out there that Maddie and I really are committed to doing this. Maybe sometime in October would be a nice kind of get to know you session with Maddie. And so that's something we're committed to do. And Sander has been nice enough to volunteer his services to help get that done. If there is anybody in the area that wants to help facilitate something like this, a live film spotting show, we'd appreciate your help. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. And I guess look forward to that maybe sometime in October.
Yeah.
Let's get to this week's poll question, Sam. Getting back to the fall movie preview concept here, we did count down our individual 6 through 10s last week, so we want to know which film from part one of our fall movie preview are you most excited about?
Yeah, which one? Across the Universe, Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, I'm Not There, In the Valley of Elah, or Ang Lee's Lust Caution. Now, I guess on that list, Adam, I think we both agreed it was I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan biopic.
Correct.
Yeah.
Or biopic.
Or biopic, whatever you want.
As you are wont to say, but that would be our number one there in this poll, certainly, because I had it as my number six. You had it as your number 6.1.
6.1.
You cheater. So that would be our pick, but certainly we know there are some good choices there, some that I'm really curious about. We both are. Obviously, they were on our list, so please send in your thoughts. Go to filmspotting.net and make your voice heard in that poll question. We also wanted to spend a couple minutes responding to some emails we received about last week's review of the movie The Invasion.
I've already forgotten that I ever watched that movie.
I know. It's out of mind that fast. But it was interesting that people wrote in and said, you know, maybe you're giving Oliver Hirschbiegel, the director, a little bit too hard of a time. People like Samuel Todd Stevens at the University of Wisconsin wrote in and said that, you know, he agrees with our assessment, but maybe we were too hard on him because, as everyone knows, if you read anything about the film, and we were aware of this as well, that the film had kind of been hijacked from him. Warner Brothers didn't like his original cut, and they brought in James McTeague and the Wachowskis, and as longtime listeners know, bringing in the V for Vendetta crew, that's not good for
Recipe
us.
Recipe for disaster.
Yeah, so they wrote in, people like S.T. Stevens, and said, hey, maybe you were too hard on him, and we think we were, and we also got a really interesting email from someone who was on the set saying,
yes, Anthony in Virginia writes, I had to write to you when you reviewed The Invasion, or as I knew it, The Visiting. I worked on this while I was in D.C. and Maryland, and trust me, it was troubled from the start back in fall 2005 when it was filmed. The production team didn't get along, and Hirschbiegel's take was not particularly loved by the studio exec. Editorial, maybe it wasn't bad enough.
Mm-hmm.
In small defense of those of us who worked damn hard on this, I still feel it's the hardest film I've worked with. The original script and cut was sure to be much better than the finished product. Once the director turned the film in to Joel Silver and Warner Brothers, they hated it and hired both the Wachowski brothers and the director of V for Vendetta to polish it up. They reshot half the movie and mashed it together, hence those bizarre flash-forwards, flashbacks that were truly heinous. Adam, you mentioned those on in the review last week. Again, love the show, guys. And before you judge my career, I have worked on a few good movies, too. Breach, The Bourne Ultimatum, to name a few, so it hasn't been a total waste.
No.
Take care. Well, there you go.
Yeah,
right,
I think
stuff.
The inside dope there from Anthony. And we did feel the need to, I guess, say or agree that maybe we were too hard on Hirschbiegel. But the fact is, we don't know what Anthony knows. We don't know everything that went on the set or
right.
how much the studio and the Wachowskis and McTeague meddled with everything. All we can do is go by the name on the credits. And so we kind of blamed Hirschbiegel, I guess, for a messy film. How much of that mess he deserves the blame for, I don't know. The fact is, I think, like a lot of critics, Sam, we too often give the director too much credit
maybe
for the things that go right on a film, and
oh,
occasionally we give them too much of the blame, too, when things go horribly wrong, as it did with The Invasion. But we did want to throw that out there. We agree with all of you who wrote in and said, hey, maybe we were a little bit too hard on him. He kind of had the movie ripped from him. So
yeah, and
like
maybe Hirschbiegel was just being diplomatic, but in that Entertainment Weekly article where they talk about how the Wachowskis and McTeague got involved, I mean, he's quoted, Hirschbiegel is quoted, and basically says, yeah, it could have used a little help. And maybe, again, he's just, you know, walking the party line there a little bit. It wouldn't really help for him to, you know, besmirch his higher-ups. But, again, maybe he liked the final cut. Who
maybe.
Knows? I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it, but you do never know. I guess we want to close out this segment with maybe just one email real quick from the batch of fall movie preview feedback that we've received so far in response to part one last week. We'll go ahead and read this one from last week's Massacre Theater winner, Michael Parks in Sugarland, Texas. He says, I agree with the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. I've also been waiting for this film since the beginning, and it is finally coming out. I just noticed, though, Sam, this is on the Toronto schedule. I'm looking forward to seeing it. It's 160 minutes long. You know
Perfect.
How I am about
that. Long movies.
I'm in Toronto. I don't have a thing about long movies. I really don't. The Godfather 2, some of my favorite films
right.
are 3 hours long.
True.
But when you're trying to see like five films in a day,
I know.
Going to a 160 minute film is not as nice as seeing maybe, you know, a 90 minute movie. And so I'm a little now hesitant, but I am still looking forward to it. Michael also adds, as for Across the Universe, I believe this film is going to bomb.
Ouch.
When I saw the preview, I said, oh no, plus the singing in quotes, is just horrible from the website.
Oh.
I probably will end up seeing it at some point, but not in the theaters. I think that's pretty much what we said. It
yeah.
could just oh. be a train wreck.
I think it absolutely will be just a complete bomb at the box office.
Yeah.
I think that is a fact. That is a statement of fact. But whether it's enjoyable or not, I mean, again, I'm all for high-risk pictures. Pictures that could either, you know, blow me away
yeah.
or just annoy me with their pretension, but I think this is absolutely one of those cases. So I'm certainly still optimistic myself.
Well, I am planning to see it at Toronto, and so is Maddie, of course. And on our September 14th show, our full show from Toronto, we'll have a couple of dispatches just as we did from Sundance, Sam.
Right.
But on that full Friday show, the 14th, we're planning right now to have a full review of Across the Universe. So I guess, Michael, we'll find out whether
yes.
or not you are right on that show. As always, if you have feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
We're going to take one last quick break. When we come back, anticipated is just another way of saying setting yourself up for disappointment, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Part two of our fall movie preview is up next. Stay with us.
Holy moly, sweet rock and roll. Is that the devil's music I hear? Turn up the dial on the radio. I don't think so. The devil saw his skinny ass on the run.
Time now to take a look at what's new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. And Sam, I think we're going to start with least compelling and work our way up to most compelling.
That's nice.
We'll start with Up in Smoke, including commentary by Cheech Marin.
Compelling.
So, yes,
yeah.
not very compelling.
No.
But all of you potheads out there, I guess Up in Smoke is out now. Check it out.
Again, where is the pairing with The Fountain?
That's
Up
a good
Smoke
point.
Slash the Fountain, double disc feature.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Also, on any given Sunday, the director's cut. Sam, can you give us some Pacino?
Oh, I wish I could do that last speech there.
Yeah.
Absentee Landlord. That's all I got. Yeah.
Wrong movie.
Yeah.
47 chapter scene selection. I guess that's a good thing. It also has a making of documentary. I don't know why it's a director's cut. It just must be really long, basically.
Be.
But it doesn't really seem to have a lot of great extra features. But the ones we're really interested in here, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, Ken Loach's film that I think won the Palme d'Or at Cannes.
In 06, yep.
Finally out now on DVD. And we both missed it from last year, a movie that we both really were anticipating. Finally out now on DVD. It includes a commentary by Ken Loach.
Yeah.
So that's one to definitely check out. And then Night on Earth and Stranger Than Paradise,
ooh,
two great films from Jim Jarmusch out now on Criterion Collection editions. So new restored digital transfers and all sorts of extra features.
Yeah, I want to say Night on Earth hadn't been available at all on DVD.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe not, but it includes a commentary by the DP on that and Q&A with Jarmusch. So lots of good stuff on those Criterion sets to definitely check out coming out this Tuesday. Before we get to donations and nicknames, I did just want to throw out a quick note about the Toronto Film Festival. A lot of people have written in and said, hey, I live in Toronto or will be in Toronto. Are you guys going to have a meetup? And Maddie and I are planning on meeting up with any listeners that want to come out, have a drink, have a bite to eat, whatever. I recommend going to filmspotting.net, clicking on the message boards link, and if you go to our local events and meetup section of the boards, and there will also be a link to this directly on filmspotting.net's homepage. You can't miss it. But if you go to our message boards and go to that thread, you will get up-to-the-minute information on what we're planning. So if you're interested in coming out, meeting up at Toronto, we'd love to have you. Just check out that link.
All right, we do want to thank a few people that went to the filmspotting.net site, clicked on the PayPal link, and donated some of their hard-earned money to FilmSpotting. And this week, really, I think there was maybe a fear that the time to get an official Sam Van Holger nickname
is now. Yes.
So we really do appreciate everybody that went and did donate some money. We want to thank, and again, it's a long list, Sit Tight, Mitchell, Discount Alienation, Alyssa, The Future is Prologue, Rebecca's Bags, File Under Fingertips, Elbow, Adam, Glass Pants, Predicament, Stephen, Recipe for Agitation, Brooks, Figurative Apoplexy, Alexander, the Burn Redeemer, a.k.a. Upsetting the Applesauce, a.k.a. The Clock Strikes Molehill, Camaria, Slighter Than Light, Scott, Architecture of Discontent, Russell, Madness at the Helm, James, Still Waters Run Fast, Kevin, Unbinding Mercies, Jonathan, It Ends When I Say It Ends, Jeffrey, Murderous Patience, Jeff, Orchestral Ascent, Jeff with a G, Rocky Mountain Low, Brian, Uneasy Alligator, and finally, Wen, Basement Terrors. Thanks to everybody that donated to Film Spotting this week.
Apoplexy. There's nothing like
apoplexy.
A nickname no one can
Figurative
say.
Figurative apoplexy. That's tough. Yeah. And again, all these nicknames and all previous nicknames are archived on the filmspotting.net site.
Holy moly, car rock and roll plays a fundamentalist lament.
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
Look, look, look! All the tapes are blank!
It's the TV, Mike.
Show me how... Why is it doing that?
Does that happen when you do it?
Uh-oh. What is wrong with you? Why is it doing that when you do that? You're magnetized! You erased these tapes! It's you!
You gotta find new tapes.
I got a better idea.
Follow me.
When you're walking down the street and you see a little ghost,
what
you gonna do about Ghostbusters?
What? What is that?
That's the Ghostbusters theme song.
No.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and that was a clip from the trailer for Be Kind Rewind. Speaking of Michelle Gondry.
Yes.
Sam, with Jack Black and Mos Def, we've had a few listeners send us that link and say, you got to check this out. Of course, this movie has been on our radar a little bit. It does look hilarious, and we are very excited to see it.
Best movie 2008. You heard it here first. Be Kind Rewind.
That is why it isn't appearing on our fall movie preview, however, as some of our listeners thought maybe it would, because right now we're seeing it as a January release date. So right. It's not making the list, and neither are a couple other movies that I know at least one listener wrote in about.
Yeah, John Heberly wrote in to say, if these films don't make your list, then you're not the hosts that I've come to know and love. And he names a few, which we've already mentioned and then maybe will mention. Coming up, but also mentioned Wong Kar Wai's My Blueberry Nights, which I think debuted at Cannes and was supposed to come out later this year, but I think is going to be pushed back to early 08, as well as Charlie Kaufman's Synecdoche, New York, which, again, I think is looking at looking like a 08 release. So, again, three films, if you include Be Kind Rewind, that would be obvious anticipated films of ours if they were coming out at the end of this year. But I guess that you can just make those your top five. You already know, I guess, the top five for your spring 08.
That's exactly right.
With Maddie and Adam.
Most anticipated of the spring, there are the three. Right there, that makes it easy. Well, let's get on to our top five movies of the fall, the five movies we're most looking forward to. And we did come up with a joint list here because we really did agree on the five films we're the most excited about. We would just have them maybe in a different order. But we have come up with a little bit of a compromise here. And Sam, I think people are going to notice a pattern, which is the pattern probably everyone out there uses when they're thinking about the movies they're excited about. They're going to see a lot of directors we love with a lot of actors or casts that we love. How else can you really judge a film? And so I think you're going to see that thread here throughout our list. But let's go ahead and get started with our joint number five.
Joint number five. And quickly, I want to mention just a few others that don't make the list that I really think this is incredibly rich. Fall, like incredibly rich.
Yeah.
Just quickly, John Cusack and Grace Is Gone, which we saw at Sundance and really liked. Woody Allen's got a new film, Cassandra's Dream. Noah Baumbach's new film, Margot at the Wedding. George Clooney's comedy, Leatherheads. Charlie Wilson's War, written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by Mike Nichols. And then Sean Penn's Into the Wild. All films I think it's fair to say both you and I are at least to some degree excited about. But we did agree on our joint number five, and it's Ridley Scott's American Gangster with Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe. Washington's Harlem drug kingpin, Frank Lucas, and Russell Crowe as the stand-up cop with these personal problems. And I said this to you where I was like, to me, this seems like the only can't miss on our top five and maybe in the top 10 or 15, really, that I've named. You know, that it really can't – it can only marginally disappoint as far as I can see. I mean, Denzel Washington's playing a badass, you know, gangster. Mm-hmm. Crow is this hard – badass cop. I mean, great cast. I mean, Ridley Scott has shown in the past a real restraint, I think, with that kind of this kind of story and these kind of actors, and just is a really good storyteller. And my one concern then, I don't know if you noticed this, Adam, screenwriter
Steven Zalian.
Zalian.
Yeah.
Could blow this for everybody.
He could, but he's, of course, had some very good films.
He has,
in his
but
past.
I mean, I was looking back. I mean, his recent track record, of course. I mean, I can't believe how often The Interpreter has come up on FilmSpy.
All the King's Men.
But it was one of the earliest horrible films we saw and agreed on. And, of course, he wrote and directed All the King's Men, which was just a debacle.
Yes.
And really, he's been poison since Searching for Bobby Fischer, which he wrote and directed, which we both loved, but he hasn't really done anything of merit since then. But I still have a great deal of hope. Like I said, this seems like the only close and shut case, can't miss.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, actually, if you look at it, because all the other films on our list could just be out-of-the-park masterpieces.
Yes.
Or maybe could be disasters, kind of like Across the Universe. I mean, they may not work completely. People are really taking risks with a lot of these films. American Gangster, I don't see how it could disappoint. And speaking of director and actor or cast pairings here, this film's gone through so many different permutations.
That's true.
Originally, Benicio del Toro was in it, was going to play the Russell Crowe role. Antoine Fuqua was directing. Then we had the Hotel Rwanda pairing of Terry George and Don Cheadle as Lucas. And I have to say, I think Russell Crowe is perfect, would be perfect in this role. I mean, that's the guy I want to see. But Denzel Washington, in this particular role, based on what I've seen, I like him even better than Don Cheadle, is an actor, though, we love a lot. I think that you put those two actors together and Ridley Scott, I think it could be great.
Yep.
Okay, well, that movie opens November 2nd in wide release. Our number four joint movie is David Cronenberg's movie Eastern Promises, the film I'm really looking forward to, one of the films I'm really looking forward to seeing in Toronto. It opens limited September 14th and comes out wide September 21st. But it's the story of a midwife in London played by Naomi Watts, my favorite actress, as you know, Sam.
All right.
And she starts investigating the death of a Russian teen who died during childbirth and somehow gets involved in prostitution. And, of course, you've got Naomi Watts, as I said, but also Viggo Mortensen reteaming with David Cronenberg, who we think maybe hit a high point in his career with 2005,
yes.
The History of Violence.
Right.
But, of course, there are others, like my new co-host and several supporters who have written in who said that we are dead wrong on that. But you take Cronenberg, Mortensen, Naomi Watts, that's all I need to know. I'm going to be excited.
Yeah, and you, because you really had to battle to get this as high as it was.
Yeah.
I was just like, yeah, it's definitely in my top 10-ish. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, we may have seen the best of Cronenberg in some way. He's a filmmaker I obviously admire, but he really is as strong as his material. And I feel like a lot of the other directors on this list either help create mm-hmm. their material, or screenwriters as well, or can somehow make their material better. Cronenberg...
Yeah.
Had a great script with History of Violence and a really good cast. And so I'm honestly completely prepared for this to be an ineffective thriller with bad Russian accents.
It could be.
That really could be. But, yeah, certainly coming out of History of Violence, I'm enthusiastic about this, too.
Well, and I agree, too, that on its face, the premise to this film isn't naturally as grabbing as A History of Violence. I mean, that whole idea of a guy not knowing who he is and was involved in this extraordinary feat, and could he be a killer? I mean, that's just naturally interesting and entertaining. So I don't know if this one will have that same hook. We will see. And we move on to our number three film, another film that I kind of had to push to get a little bit higher, Sam, which I think listeners will be surprised. Maybe you can explain why it wouldn't be higher on your list. But we do agree it comes in at number three on our list, and that is No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers movie that comes out. And for me, the Coen Brothers alone, that name, that phrase is why it vaults to number three. That's all you really need to know. But then you add in that it's an adaptation of a Cormac McCarthy novel, which I guess at its most basic level is about a drug deal gone bad set along the Rio Grande. Javier Bardem, a really intriguing actor we've liked in other films, is in it, along with Tommy Lee Jones, Woody Harrelson, and Josh Brolin.
In two of our top five films.
Yeah, he's coming out in a lot of these films this fall, and he really stood out in Planet Terror, and he's a guy who's kind of always flown under the radar. I'm curious what you think about all of a sudden Josh Brolin being thrust into the spotlight, but you can comment on that. But again, this movie comes out November 9th, The Limited. It expands November 16th, and it's one I'm dying to see in Toronto. And I also really have to thank M. Robert Turnage, our elegant nemesis. He actually sent me a birthday present this week, Sam.
Oh.
And he sent me, along with the Raging Bull special edition, about that? He sent me Cormac McCarthy's novel, No Country for Old Men, which I'm not going to have time to read before Toronto. And even if I did have time, I'd probably hold off just because I don't want to be thinking about it the entire time I'm watching the Coen Brothers. But that's our number three.
A couple of our listeners have written in to say how good Cormac McCarthy's most recent novel is, The Road, which I think won the Pulitzer last year. So Cormac McCarthy, so that's intriguing. And I guess I don't know if I've ever said this on air, but I don't have a huge enthusiasm for Coen Brothers films. I've found them over time to be kind of stylized and a little like...
You think?
Well, very stylized, obviously. That's an understatement. But just that there's a kind of lack of emotion. There's an emotional remove to the films, which, again, I really liked the Coen Brothers, I think, when I was in my early 20s. And I've sort of, I don't know, I've lost a little bit of enthusiasm for them. And really, the only film I absolutely love of the Coen Brothers is Lebowski.
Yeah.
And Miller's Crossing, too, I like a lot. But
I was going to say, I thought your Big Lebowski fan club card was going to be revoked.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, again, and it's not like I think that Lebowski is so much different from their other films. It's just maybe more endearing than a lot of their other films. But again, I totally agree. I'm enthusiastic about it. Let's see where it goes. All right, well, our joint number two, and again, this is, again, where we had a bit of an argument.
I'd have it a little lower.
It's the new Wes Anderson. It's Darjeeling Limited. And the fact is, I don't know why I'm fighting it for it to be at number two, really, because as far as I'm concerned, Wes Anderson is really batting 500 now. Bottle Rocket, one of my favorite films of all time. Rushmore, a masterpiece. Royal Tenenbaums, Diminishing Returns, and Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Adam, you and I both agree.
We don't like it.
Oh, maybe overstating it to say almost unwatchable, but really dull. a movie I vow to see before I see Darjeeling Limited, which, based on the trailers, I have to say just looks like Wes Anderson, which not trying something new. We've got these three brothers reuniting after a year on the spiritual quest in India. Owen Wilson, Jason Schwartzman, and Adrian Brody. And if you pay very close attention to the trailer, you'll note co-starring Irfan Khan.
Oh, wow.
The greatest actor
ever,
currently
according
working
to you.
And ever. The script co-written by Wes Anderson, Jason Schwartzman, and Roman Coppola, who's in it as well, and a second unit director for his sister Sophia and his dad, Francis Ford Coppola, of course, and Wes Anderson. And so it's Wes Anderson, which is still an event movie for me. The fact that he's got a new movie.
It is an event movie.
And I love the cast, of course. I mean, watching the trailer, Jason Schwartzman makes me laugh looking at his face each and every time.
Yeah.
But I'm very skeptical at the same time.
Sure. Sure. I mean, he's got a really great eclectic cast as always, though I have to be honest, Angelica Houston has kind of always driven me nuts, even going back to Crimes and Misdemeanors,
a film,
I absolutely love. And of course, The Jury for us is still out on Natalie Portman. I don't even know if The Jury's out. I think you've already weighed in, Sam, maybe on Natalie Portman, but she's in it as well. But it is Wes Anderson. It is an event film, and it is our number two. It comes out at the end of September just in New York, and then it expands the first week in October. Not playing at Toronto, sadly, but it is a film we're dying to see, which brings us to our number one joint pick, and this was a slam dunk, no-brainer. There was no equivocation about this one. This was our number one. There Will Be Blood, director P.T. Anderson, and the actor, Sam?
And the actor, Mr. Daniel Day-Lewis. How can you argue with that pairing? I mean, literally, if you just told me, and I was surprised to find that if you just told me P.T. Anderson has a new movie, that's my number one automatically.
Probably.
And I was actually kind of surprised to see that. There's a lot of great filmmakers making great movies. But really, where Wes Anderson, my enthusiasm has waned, really my enthusiasm for P.T. Anderson is only, what's the opposite of waned? Waxed, I guess. and really, I think part of it is that Punch Drunk Love is at risk of entering my pantheon of top five films of all time. And I just, I really admire what he does. I really think he's a real artist in some way, and I really think his choices are never obvious, and he's a really curious filmmaker. And then you add Daniel Day-Lewis. I mean, I know I already in this within the last 2 minutes named Irfan Khan the greatest actor of all time.
But you mean it.
Well, let's
time.
Go out on a hyperbolic moment. But Daniel Day-Lewis, I mean, as time and time again, just a great, great actor, what he brings to films.
Yeah, it's an adaptation of the Upton Sinclair novel, Oil, set at the turn of the century, a period piece, Daniel Day-Lewis as an oil baron of some kind, and also has Paul Dano in it from Little Miss Sunshine, who I liked a lot in that movie. So There Will Be Blood, our hands-down number one film of the fall, the one we're most looking forward to, and it is slated to open the day after Christmas. That's our top five.
All right, well, that does, conclude our fall movie preview, parts one and two. Please send your top five most anticipated films or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message.
New in theaters this weekend, Balls of Fury, Christopher Walken, What Has Become of You, Halloween, the Rob Zombie update of the classic John Carpenter film. I know Sam's going to be in line for that one.
No doubt.
Death Sentence, the Kevin Bacon film. Man, I don't know if there's a film out right now I'm less interested in seeing than
Death
Sentence.
Idea what it's about, but I just like Kevin Bacon.
Okay. Next week on the show, as we said, a review of Shoot 'Em Up, our top five farewells, and our top five or 10 or 15 fantastic moments.
If you can scratch some up, yeah. All right, well, thanks to Alex and Angela in our message boards, Frank Huckle, Candace Griffiths, and Jeff Houston. Thanks also to Dan Burt, Yes Bacon, as I like to call him, or Dan Burt, No Bacon, and Bloodshot Records for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Holger.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
Be sure to get away from the mic if you're going to yell.
I'm going to, I was sure to practice.
Okay.
I'm not going to do it at full volume.
Nice. Okay. You're a professional.
I'm a professional.
Yeah, okay.
Broadcaster.
Here we go.
Timber, yes, bacon. That's gold.